Christopher Dunn is an engineer with more than 35 years of experience. He was recruited by the American Aerospace Company in 1969 and began as a skilled machinist and toolmaker, and has worked at almost every level of high-tech manufacturing, from building to operating high-powered industrial lasers, including the position of project engineer and laser operations manager at Danville Metal Stamping, a Midwest aerospace manufacturer. Dunn's Pyramid Odyssey began in 1977 when he read Peter Tompkins' book, Secrets of the Great Pyramid. His immediate reaction to the Giza Pyramid's schematics was that this edifice was a gigantic machine. Discovering the purpose of this machine involved a process of reverse engineering that has taken over 24 years of research. In the process, he has published more than a dozen magazine articles and has appeared on several national television programs. Chris is also the author of the best-selling book on the pyramids called The Giza Power Plant, and he's back on Coast to Coast. Hi, Chris. How are you?
Hi, George.
Always my pleasure to have you
on.
Oh,
it's great to be back. Thank you.
How quickly time flies, huh?
It's been over 2 years.
Yeah, it's getting there.
Almost. Not quite. Just over 1 year.
Year and a half. You know, and when we last talked, and let's go back a little bit, as we said, back in the time. We talked about the Gatenbrink's door. Now, all of that was first found when? In 1993?
Yes. 1993 was when they did the exploration with Upuat 2.
Okay.
And at that time, they didn't know what was at the end of this small shaft. The shaft was actually, it was unknown until the year 1872, when an explorer, Wayne Mendixon, was in the pyramid, and he detected a crack in the wall of the so-called Queen's Chamber. And detecting a crack, he just poked around and banged on the wall, and he detected a hollow sound. He pushed a rod through this crack, and the rod just kept on going. So he had a fellow chisel out the limestone and found the shaft, just exposed the shaft to the world at that point. Then he measured off the opposite wall, which was on the north side of the Queen's Chamber, and detected the same features there, and chiseled out the limestone there, and sure enough, there was another shaft going in the northerly direction.
Well,
these shafts go straight for about 3 feet, then they shoot off at an angle.
Number of predictions made at the time, Chris. Let me review some of those for us so people get an understanding of where you're coming from tonight. Zahi Hawass, of course, who heads up Egypt's antiquities, predicted that a book or some kind of sacred scroll would be found. German Egyptologist Rainier Stettelmann, who directed the work of Rudolf Gatenbrink in 1993, he expressed that the so-called door was a false door for the king's soul to pass through on its way to Osiris, represented by the star Sirius. He believed that the copper fittings were handles that the king would use to lift the door. Robert Bavall, author of The Orion Mystery, he predicted that a statue would be discovered and that the end of the shaft served as a surdep from which the ancient Egyptians viewed the stars. And then you and I, of course, had a phone call that came in on the 15th when you were on the program, 2002, someone identifying herself as an Egyptologist and claimed to know what was behind the door. And she dismissed your hypothesis on what would be behind the door, claiming that they would find a space 30 feet long that contained sacred sand. And then John Anthony West, author of The Serpent in the Sky, commented that there would be nothing but core masonry behind this door. So Zahi Hawass on live television did what he did with the technology that was behind him, and I guess we never found out, did we, really?
We never did go back and revisit what was exactly found behind the door, and this is the first time on Coast to Coast that we've done that.
Absolutely.
And so I'm really delighted to be here, to be able to do that.
How many of these predictions, if any, get close to what you think?
Well, none of the, I think actually John Anthony West's prediction was the closest. If you consider that when the camera poked through that hole, it actually did see the termination and some core masonry. But significant to what was behind this so-called door is it was a gap about the size of a bread box.
That went to, I guess, another door, right?
Well,
or something.
It was described as another door, and I must take exception to the nomenclature that has been attached to these features. A door is, well, you know, when is a door not a door? And that's
sure.
When it's on the end of a shaft in the Great Pyramid. But but basically, you know, even Zahi Hawass himself would say a door maybe for a rat, but
mm-hmm.
certainly not for any human. And I think too that you get a different perspective when you're watching the exploration of these shafts, because the robot, as it travels the length of the shaft, sends back an image that essentially fills your television screen, pretty much the same way a camera going through a large cathedral would fill your television screen. But you tend to forget that you're traveling through a space that is only about 8 inches square. And so everything is magnified accordingly. So the blockage is actually a blockage. And basically what we have prior to, and the way I had made my prediction was based on all the evidence that is found elsewhere in the Great Pyramid.
Well, and it was a dramatic prediction, if I can recall. You basically said that if your prediction was not the correct one, that it would throw all your theories right out the window.
It would definitely seriously impact the hypothesis, yes, because any hypothesis is based in good science. It has to be predictable and falsifiable. And if evidence turns up that is not predictable, does not fit within the hypothesis or theory, then either the hypothesis has to be drastically revised or essentially thrown out.
Well, your theory, Chris, is dramatic, not only because of what you believe the Great Pyramid was built for, but also I think the ramifications of who built it and what was going on this planet during this time period. Let's review a little bit on what you told us on September 15th of 2002. You told us a little bit about the shaft, but I'll let you put it in your own words.
Well, basically, the features within the Great Pyramid, as I started to study the pyramid and reviewing all other theories, the Great Pyramid seemed to have gotten the most attention, mainly because it's the largest, it's the most precise, it has the most unusual interior characteristics or architecture, and they are indeed extremely significant. And if you consider anything to be a smoking gun of an advanced civilization, the Great Pyramid is one. But I think that we have, over the centuries, become so used to the Great Pyramid being there that we have tended to cram it into a time period, or we have a concept of a culture that constructed the Great Pyramid that was not very advanced technologically. But if this Great Pyramid was suddenly discovered in today's society, and we had the different group of people actually looking at this structure, in other words, if we had scientists, physicists, engineers, acoustic engineers, all different disciplines looking at this particular structure, that was just now discovered, we would be getting a totally different story out of this Great Pyramid.
Well, and they would be baffled about how it was built too.
How it came to be, and certainly if we were to find this in an area where the civilization surrounding it was I would say if you go back 100 or 200 or even 1,000 years in Egypt, the technologies or the understanding of science and technology and engineering back then was not at a level that was capable of really understanding the significance of this structure.
I've always believed, Chris, that the marvel of the pyramids will probably go, I think, for years and years without us finding definitive proof. Of course, theories, including yours, are there, and they're darn good ones. I saw a report on the History Channel last night, and it was still another one of these theories where this person predicted that what happened was is the pyramid originally was built in steps, and then they built smaller steps around it and filled it in, and then the final was smoothing the whole thing out with limestone, almost like cement.
Mm-hmm.
And I went, but he explained that the rocks, the boulders that came to the top, were pulled up by ropes. Mm-hmm. And there's just no way. There's no way. How are you going to pull those things up by ropes? The ropes would break.
Yeah, the logistics of building the Great Pyramid are tremendous indeed. And it has been an intellectual teaser for a lot of people, you know, technologists, people who just love to stretch their mind and try to figure out how the Great Pyramid was built. And I'm no different than anybody else. And I think until somebody could actually demonstrate that they can actually do the work, one theory is almost as good as another. I say almost because I think some theories are better than others, but certainly your comment about how do you raise a 70-ton block, a granite block, 200 feet in the air using ropes? That's a significant question,
yeah,
and
sure
I don't think that anybody's really answered it properly.
Your theory that those handles that were in the shaft on the so-called door, as some have said, were handles to open up the door. You say that they were almost electrodes or parts of a copper cable. And that, I think, was the basis for your theory, and it's probably the most revolutionary of anything I've heard so far.
Yes, the interesting thing is that the hypothesis, the power plant hypothesis, has always described these shafts as being conduits, if you will, for a chemical or a fluid feeding into the Queen's Chamber. And even in 1993, as I saw Gantenbrink's exploration of the southern shaft, and not knowing what was at the end of it, the hypothesis was formulated and also had been, I had the book written essentially. It hadn't been formally published, but certainly the hypothesis was intact at that time. And so when the Upuat II came to the end of the shaft and there were two copper fittings there, I was sitting with a friend of mine, Jeff Summers, in his living room watching this exploration, and he commented, well, they look like electrodes. And my response was, bingo, you know, it's just like we both hit it right at the same time that they look like electrodes. And it really made sense to me because I had been involved in fluid switches. I know how they work, and basically the need to have them there became immediately obvious because in order to feed the chemical into the chamber, you would need to know what the head pressure was on the column of chemical or the fluid,
right?
And so the shaft would have to be full at all times in order to dictate what the feed rate would be into the chamber, and that is why they would need a feedback mechanism, so that when the shaft was filled with this chemical, which I predicted was I speculate is hydrochloric acid solution, that there would be a connection, there would be electron flow between the anode and the cathode, And then when the fluid level dropped, that would signal for more solution to be fed into the shaft.
It was like a meter, wasn't it?
Exactly. And so basically that is a very simple effective means of maintaining the level of fluid or the weight of the column of water.
Well, are you saying though that the Great Pyramid was a huge battery?
No, actually it's a lot more sophisticated than a battery. The solutions feeding into the chamber, I theorize, actually combined to create hydrogen. And the hydrogen was critical, it was crucial to the operation of the power plant. And so everything in the Great Pyramid actually comes together into a very cohesive unit. One piece of the Great Pyramid, which could be at a totally different part of the Great Pyramid, has a connection to every other part. In other words, the southern shaft in the Queen's Chamber is connected in some way and has a purpose to the function of the northern shaft in the King's Chamber, or the five overlaying layers of granite on top of the King's Chamber.
And do you believe later, Christopher, maybe thousands and thousands of years later, the Egyptians then used the pyramid as possible tombs, probably not even knowing what the original intent was? Is that possible?
Well, it is a fact that people were interred in pyramids after in later periods. That is certainly not new. It's not a new hypothesis or even a hypothesis. It's a known fact that most pyramids where mummies have been found, that they found that the mummies were actually interred there thousands of years after the pyramid was built.
Which does not negate the fact that, as you believe, it was a power plant originally.
Originally, yes.
Yes.
I mean, I'm not saying that there were no mummies found in pyramids, because that would be a lie.
Right.
They
right.
certainly were. But those mummies that have been found have been determined to have been put there later. And, you know, there are a lot of people today that if they could find a final resting place in the King's Chamber in the Great Pyramid, I'm sure that they would go for it. But I don't think that anybody is that powerful to accomplish that right now.
Something must have happened between when the pyramid was being used as a power plant to when the ancient Egyptians began using it as a tomb for their pharaohs, let's say, and their leaders. Something in between. There must have been an incredible gap of time, thousands of years perhaps. Were you ever able to find out what you think happened in between? What created that gap?
You know, I think your show is a fertile ground for the discussion of a lot of those different ideas. And, you know, I've listened to different discussions about Earth changes and catastrophes. I definitely do believe that, and, you know, it's obvious that there have been cataclysms in the past. And these cataclysms have affected a large section of the population on the planet Earth. I think what we have to recognize, and sometimes it's very difficult to come to this realization, is that the civilization that built the Great Pyramid was probably more than likely subject to one of these cataclysms.
You may be right. Stay with us, Christopher. Let's take this quick break, and we'll come right back and talk with you about this, because this is indeed a fascinating theory. Plus, if they were using it as a power plant to extract hydrogen, what were they using the hydrogen for? I'll be back in a moment. And Christopher Dunn, our guest, right here on Coast to Coast, his website, GizaPower.com, linked up right now with CoastToCoastAM.com. Christopher, if it was a power plant and they were extracting hydrogen out of this system, what were they using the hydrogen for?
Well, I think, first of all, what we have to do is we have to look at the where all the action was, where everything was taking place.
Okay.
That is the so-called King's Chamber. And the King's Chamber is about 175 feet up in the center of the Great Pyramid. It is comprised of thousands upon thousands of tons of igneous rock. rose quartz granite with about 55% silicon quartz crystal. The interesting thing about this chamber is in the 1880s, William Flinders Petrie, who was the world's first Egyptologist, or is credited to be the world's first Egyptologist, the father of Egyptology, actually noted something very strange about this chamber and wrote about it. He said that this chamber had been subject to a tremendous disturbance, and that the walls had been pushed out over an inch, and the ceiling beams had been cracked along the south end. That caught my attention. The reason for it has been credited to the earthquake activity in the area.
Mm-hmm.
However, in the same publication, Petrie talks about his measurements of other features within the Great Pyramid. Significantly, the one feature that caught my attention was the descending passage. And this descending passage, it descends on a 23.5 degree angle down to a subterranean chamber. It's about 150 feet through the upper portion of the pyramid, the constructed portion of the pyramid, and then about 200 feet further through the bedrock to the chamber. Interestingly, this descending passage, which is only about 42 inches square, and we could probably talk for a long time about how they constructed that, but over the 150 feet of the constructed portion, the passage was straight within 20,000ths of an inch. Absolutely perfectly straight.
See, and you would think that that would get out of kilter if there were earthquakes.
That's my point.
Yeah.
The lower parts of the Great Pyramid did not display the same disturbance as the King's Chamber.
Mm-hmm.
It seemed that everything else, every other part of the Great Pyramid, the internal structures, all the blocks were in alignment and perfectly matched. And if you go through there today, you will see that they talk about the precision of the blocks on the outside of the Great Pyramid. The precision on the blocks on the inside, particularly the walls of the Queen's Chamber, the Grand Gallery, and the King's Chamber, the blocks fit together with no deviation whatsoever.
I'm not sure.
You wouldn't be able to get a razor blade in between those blocks.
Exactly. It is that close together.
It is that precise. And so when we see this accuracy and precision, I mean, just just having that accuracy and precision in a building is significant enough. But then this isolated chamber up in the center of the Great Pyramid, a different kind of chamber, constructed of igneous rock, has had this tremendous disturbance, and the walls were not collapsed or did not seem to have been buckled in like you would expect in an earthquake, that things normally fall in on themselves rather than be pushed out. So it indicated to me that there had been a force generated within that chamber that caused the walls to push out, an explosion. And that particular bit of information was what got me started on the power plant theory determine how everything else worked.
Now, let me ask you about that, or an explosion. I mean, could this very well be almost like a piston in a car, you know, where there's this constant ignition of gasoline? The piston, of course, goes up and down, but in this particular case, might it have been more than just one explosion? Could it have been ongoing?
Actually, no.
Just so a one-time blast.
Not the way that I view it. And really, what I have to do is to draw out the other evidence to explain how I believe the pyramid functioned. And really, it involved hydrogen in a way that did not cause any explosion. That was not a part of the process. The hypothesis describes the function of the Great Pyramid as the hydrogen as being a part of a a MASR, which is a microwave amplification through stimulated emission radiation. So it was actually generating microwave energy and beaming that energy through another conduit, which is the southern shaft of the King's Chamber. Now, the evidence to support that is the rest of the Great Pyramid, including the Grand Gallery and the other features in the King's Chamber. Now, we'll talk a little more about the King's Chamber because this is very important to understand.
Sure.
That there are features there that a lot of times, you know, you can spin a story or spin a theory about something, and you have different interpretations, and one just has as much validity as another. But when you look at this particular chamber, you see that there are features in here that really do not belong there if all this chamber did was to house a body or to have a ceremony or any other function for human habitation.
Way too sophisticated for that. Christopher, also let me ask you, the other two pyramids in Giza, the two smaller ones, did they have any kind of tie-in with the big one at all?
I believe they did.
Okay, we'll get to that later.
I believe they did. They were all a part of a system. And let us first of all go back to, because I want to unfold the evidence and move away out from the King's Chamber.
Right.
And then once we understand once we ask the right questions in the King's Chamber, then the answers that feed into it from the rest of the pyramid and the other pyramids begin to make more sense.
Okay. Go ahead.
So in above the King's Chamber, we have five layers of these granite monoliths. The monoliths is about 43 giant granite beams. They weigh up to 70 tons apiece. Now, they are layered in steps. On the underside and the sides and the underneath of the beams are straight and square. But the top side of these beams are very, very rough, and they've got holes gouged in them. And the question immediately is, why do we have five layers of these granite beams? Obviously, it took a tremendous amount of work to bring these beams down from Aswan, which is where they were quarried.
Mm-hmm.
And Aswan is about 500 miles away from the Great Pyramid. Haul them down to the Giza Plateau and then elevate them up into the center of the Great Pyramid, 200 feet up in the air. A tremendous amount of work. Just the quarrying, the cutting, the moving. What a tremendous amount of work for five layers of these granite beams. Now, the conventional hypothesis or theory for why those five layers exist is that they were needed to relieve the stress or the weight of the pyramid, the superstructure, so that the King's Chamber could have a flat ceiling. That is the official theory.
And that it wouldn't collapse within itself?
That it would not collapse.
Yeah.
Now, look at the Queen's Chamber. This is a chamber that is underneath the King's Chamber.
Mm-hmm.
What we have is a greater amount of weight sitting on top of the Queen's Chamber, and a simple ceiling design, which is a gabled, cantilevered blocks that are bearing the weight of the entire pyramid on top of it.
Nothing special to support
it. Nothing special.
No.
Now, what, George, if we wanted a flat ceiling in the Queen's Chamber, could we have a flat ceiling in the Queen's Chamber? Absolutely.
Sure.
All we would have to do is just put in some stringers and we'd have a flat ceiling. Now, why do we have five layers above the King's Chamber? They certainly knew how to construct a chamber that would bear all the weight of the Great Pyramid.
And with this kind of stone as well.
And with this kind of stone. Now, what we have is granite, though. And granite has specific properties.
Mm-hmm.
It's very resonant. it sings. And the other features within the King's Chamber, and the other evidence that has come to light, is that this chamber is actually resonating in ultrasonic frequencies, infrasonic frequencies, rather. And those frequencies are between 2 and 9 hertz. And in 1996, I believe, it was when Tom Danley, an acoustic engineer, went to Egypt as part of the Shore expedition. And he took some acoustic sounding tests within the King's Chamber. And he said that even with no external stimuli, that the pyramid or the chamber was resonating between 2 and 9 hertz. And it was actually forming a F-sharp chord.
Well, this is something. Cause
doesn't that absolutely blow your mind?
It does.
Now, when you look at the... when you look at the beams above the King's Chamber, and you look at the way they have been constructed or excavated, the question that I pose, or what I propose in my book, is that they had actually tuned each of those beams to specifically resonate with a certain frequency. And so energy coming into that chamber, sonic energy, vibration, would cause those of the right frequency, would cause all of those beams to vibrate.
In that resonance would go everywhere, wouldn't it?
And it would be contained within that particular chamber. Now, this is where it really, really gets fascinating, in my opinion. What we have within the King's Chamber is actually a geometry and design which is designed to actually capture acoustic energy and allow that acoustic energy to build. The other fascinating thing, and this information, it comes to us from different sources, and my research, I do not reject any source as far as information or interesting tidbits or personal experiences.
I understand.
Paul Horn, you remember? You know who Paul Horn
is? Right.
Yes, he was a transcendental flautist. He actually made a recording inside the King's Chamber, and that is a fascinating CD. It's available on CD at Amazon.com now, but it's called Inside the Great Pyramid,
mm-hmm.
And a booklet that accompanied this particular. Actually, it was an LP when I got it. I got it when when the CDs weren't born yet. But
before 8-tracks, right?
Yeah. Actually, no. I had an 8-track in my Camaro at the time. But this particular LP, as I played it, it was absolutely amazing. He plays the flute inside the King's Chamber. In the dark with candles, and the recording is fascinating. You hear on the CD he's striking the sarcophagus, or the so-called sarcophagus, the box inside the chamber, and it's resonating. He's tuning his flute to that particular frequency, and then he plays. But what caught my attention was his narrative in the booklet that accompanied the LP. And he said, and he played the flute inside the Queen's Chamber, and then he went out into the Grand Gallery, which is just outside the King's Chamber. And to actually, you have to go through the Grand Gallery, or climb the Grand Gallery, on the way into the King's Chamber. And the entranceway to the King's Chamber is only about 42 inches square. So he went out to the top of the Grand Gallery and played his flute. And he said, it sounded rather flat. It was very interesting because he was playing his flute. There was nothing coming back at him from the Grand Gallery, but there was something coming back to him from the King's Chamber. the sound was, the music was going out into the Grand Gallery, and it was being reflected off the surfaces of the Grand Gallery, and then focusing into the King's Chamber. And it was capturing that sound, and it was resonating within the King's Chamber. So that was another piece of evidence that supported the power plant theory, because what we have in the Grand Gallery is it's a fascinating structure, and it's called a miracle of architecture. It is about 157 feet long, 28 feet high. The walls are about 80 inches wide at the bottom and 42 inches wide at the top, and the walls actually step in a series of seven steps on the way to the ceiling. And the ceiling is kind of a ratchet-type ceiling. The tiles on the ceiling actually tilt in towards the center of the pyramid or the King's Chamber.
This entire structure, and including the two smaller ones, in terms of its use, and we'll talk more about that when we come back at the top of the hour, Christopher, but was it for a certain region? How far out would it be used for in terms of distance, do you think?
Well, I would speculate, and my sense is that all the pyramids in Egypt combined served a particular function, and it was a multi-purpose function. The pyramids were actually used to drive the planet into harmony. In other words, they were singing to the earth, and the earth was actually responding.
It was singing back.
They're singing back.
Stay with us.
They were gathering that energy and converting it.
And maybe for some reason they were trying to avert maybe a polar shift, for example. Maybe they had reason for this. We'll be back in a moment. If you happen to have a computer, if you look at this picture of Christopher Dunn in this tomb tunnel, you just got to just be marveled by the way they polished the granite. I mean, it's perfect. It's absolutely perfect. Of course, they did that by hand, right? Christopher, how do you polish granite this way and it's perfectly smooth? How do you do that?
Well, you can polish granite using a slurry of quartz, and there are several ways. You can rub one stone against another with a slurry in between and polish it that way.
I mean, would it be uniform? I mean, that's what I'm saying.
Where we depart from the question, what did they use to actually cut and polish these artifacts, but to what did they use to actually check the work or inspect them? Because of the geometry and the precision of the artifacts, it's obviously, and it is an absolute fact, that it was intentionally done, and that they had to have had some kind of metrology equipment to maintain their precision. And if you look on my website, you'll see both photographs side by side, with the underside of the lid, which is absolutely square to the
with your head is hitting the
wall,
lid. Yeah.
Correct. Okay. Now take the lid off and look at the geometry of the box. This is a box that is cored out of solid granite. This is not a five-piece construction, which is essentially what I was quoted when I tried to get a manufacturer to quote actually creating one of these things. They said they couldn't do it. They didn't have the equipment.
So you're saying this is one big piece?
This is a one-piece structure, a solid structure, and cored out and then finally finished, geometrically perfect. If you look at both photographs side by side, what this photograph tells you, two pictures tell 2,000 words actually, because when you start to examine what it would take to actually create this artifact, just looking at that single 14-inch length and going over to the other side of the box and the same 14-inch length And we see that it's perfectly square to the underside of the lid. What that means is that those two surfaces opposite each other had to be perfectly parallel before the lid was put on.
No deviation at all.
No deviation whatsoever. Perfectly parallel. The underside of the lid had to be perfectly flat. And it is perfectly flat. The surfaces are flat, vertically and horizontally.
Could a precision laser have cut that stone?
The laser is not a good tool to use.
It is not. Okay, what kind of a tool do you think might have been used?
Well, the you could use a diamond tool. Today we would use copper with a diamond impregnated cup. And
could we do this today? Exactly.
If we had a very special need to do something like this, yes, we could.
We could do that today.
Yes.
Could we have done it 100 years ago?
If we had had a very special need, we would have had the knowledge to do it 100 years ago. Basically, what I am saying is that the kind of work polishing telescopes goes back many, many hundreds of years.
Sure. But we're talking about 5 or 10,000 years ago.
But we're looking at surfaces that were not deemed necessary until the dawn of the Industrial Revolution.
And we're not talking about a 6 to 8 inch piece of glass either.
Right. We're talking about a very flat surface, flat to the point where on the photograph too, you'll see a metal bar with holes in it. That is a precision straight edge. The edge is ground to a precision of 1/10,000th of an inch.
Were you amazed when you were in this tunnel?
I was absolutely blown away.
Yeah.
The precision is one part of it. The other part of it is, and this is a very interesting story, is that when we look at this precision, we say, why would they need such precision? If they just wanted a nice polished surface, then we would find a nice polished surface. It wouldn't have to be flat. You could still see your face in it or, see a reflection in it. It wouldn't have to be so precise. And yet that metal bar with the 1/10,000th of an inch, which is about 1/20th the thickness of a human hair, by the way, that metal bar fits snug and flat against those inside surfaces and the underside of the lid without any deviation. Now, the other part of this whole facility, when you go down into these rock tunnels, you'll see that there is an unfinished lid in a cavern type holding area, and jammed into one of the tunnels is an unfinished box. So, George, they were actually bringing these massive objects underground to finish them.
I mean, it's just
it's mind blowing.
It really is. You ready for some calls, Christopher?
Yeah, sure. Go ahead.
Okay. Also, I want to report that Sky News is reporting that U.S. troops have captured the Shiite Muslim radical leader Al-Sadr. And Sky News has been known to be wrong before, but they are saying that they may have picked him up or an aide. They've got a picture of him. So U.S. troops have arrested the Muslim radical leaders. Oh, his top aide, and now they've added that. So they've got a picture of the Shiite Muslim leader, but they're saying they've picked up his top aide. And there's more to this than meets the eye. So we'll just monitor this and try to figure out who indeed they did capture. But they're on their way. Let's go to our phones. Let's go to our wild card line. Welcome to Coast to Coast. You are on the air. Hi there.
Good day, Chris and George.
Hello, sir.
Good day.
Mark in Austin listened to you on KLIF. I was most interested listening because you're the first person, because I've heard other people talk about it and I've read books on, the amazing things and with the pyramids and the structures and what about the sound. Mm-hmm. And I've got a question I just want to give a short background on. During the harmonic convergence, myself and 73 other people spent from midnight till 3 o'clock in the morning in the King's Chamber in Cheops.
Look at you.
Yeah. And then at 3 o'clock, they allowed us to go out and sit down and do a meditation in between the paws of the Sphinx. Just as everybody was leaving out, and I found the grand entry as you go up those steps way up to the King's Chamber, I found an amazing the way that that's set out with all the surfacing on the facing of it and all that kind of stuff. And then you've got this look to me, I didn't check it as we went in, but it was like almost, it looked to me, perfectly square hole that they'd taken the thing out. And then you have this room in there. Mm-hmm. But the sound resonance thing was of particular interest to me because I was the last person out. Mm-hmm. And most everybody was down at the lower level, at the bottom of entry into the grand entrance area. And I just had this overwhelming need to start toning. And I have a pretty low voice, but not at the level you were talking about. So I was just, and I did for about 10 minutes as everybody was getting out of that area, just toning inside of that and the resonance in it, because I've also heard that Paul Horn album and it's just amazing.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
The resonance in there, it felt like, I mean, no way to scientifically prove this, but it felt like to me my cells of my body were being uplifted, let's just put it that way. I mean, they were vibrating a very quick sound. Mm-hmm. And because I'm quite intuitive, I asked as I was coming down after this was going on, because I couldn't stop. It was just an urge that I had to fulfill. And after I stopped and was going down those steps to exit, I just said, questioned to myself, what was that all about? And basically what I was told as I was going off towards the Sphinx was that area was going to soon be sealed off, and that toning energy was just to kind of clear out the gazillions of energies that were left in there by folks that had, been up there and marveled at it but really didn't have much sense of its amazement, the sacred geometry and what it may have been used for. So I'm wondering if you have any indication of either that particular pyramid or other places was ever used in, like, ceremonies using toning.
Well, I think the Great Pyramid certainly today is very good, is a good instrument to be inside and to use as toning. The what I found when I was there in 1995, and I write about this in my book, is the resonance of that chamber. I had asked to be left alone inside the chamber, and actually I paid about, I think, $150 to have a private meditation, they called it.
Who'd you have to pay?
It was the inspector of the Giza Plateau.
Well, he put it in his pocket or what?
I really didn't care where he put it. I just needed to.
I want all the details, Christopher. I want all the details.
All the details. Well, I think we'd have to go back in time about 9 years.
All right, go ahead.
But I was, when I was there, it was my intention to actually take some readings with an RF counter to see what what radio frequencies maybe the granite may be putting out. And so I had asked to be left alone, and I also had a monochromatic tuner where I actually tested the frequencies, it was very interesting. The lights weren't turned out, first of all. I had a tape recorder that I was recording on. The lights weren't turned out, and so I stumbled through the opening onto the Grand Gallery, into the Grand Gallery, and I yelled down for them to turn out the lights. And then I walked back, crawled back into the chamber, and then finally when the lights were put out, I started to do the intoning, approximating the frequencies of the chamber and taking some readings. But interestingly, when I played back my recording after in my hotel room, there were some unusual frequencies that showed up. Number one, each footfall that I made going across the chamber and through the passageway caused the chamber to resonate at 440 hertz. That was what the tuner picked up.
Mm-hmm.
Then another interesting thing, as I was intoning, and of course my own voice was overpowering my hearing at the time.
Right.
But the tape recorder that was picking up the sound was picking up some overtones, higher frequencies, which were actually, when I played back the tape, they became even stronger.
Where were they coming from?
It was actually the effect of the chamber itself and the acoustic of the chamber.
Which is probably ongoing.
Right, and that tape, by the way, has been analyzed, and there are some significant discoveries, or some significant information, I would say, that is going to be forthcoming in the future about the acoustic nature of the Great Pyramid.
Let's go to our West of the Rockies line. Welcome to Coast. Hi there.
Yeah, how you doing?
Fine, sir.
Yeah, I have my own theory or hypothesis on the pyramids. Like Casey touched on the theory that the Egyptians did defeat an unknown people a long time ago, and it still hasn't been deciphered who the people were. But it's also the Egyptians who told Solon of Atlantis, and where the story of Atlantis originates. Now, there's that diver in the 80s who was diving somewhere off the coast of Bimini, somewhere on Bimini, and dove into the tip of a pyramid and retrieved that crystal ball, which was featured on the In Search Of series back in the 80s. Now, my hypothesis is that if the Egyptians defeated the, like Casey says, the Atlanteans, some people that fled Atlantis and landed in Egypt, and what the Egyptians tried to do is recreate the pyramids that were somehow some energy source that Atlantis has and was probably well known back in that time, and the Egyptians tried to recreate that.
Of course, and if they overtook the Atlanteans, it probably was just because of sheer numbers, I would guess.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, who knows what that case may be? The Atlanteans were certainly mm-hmm. wouldn't have been as strong as they were back when, before Atlantis was destroyed.
Well, Christopher, any theory is always possible.
I think it makes
possible.
There has been some great speculation and mythology, and I find that it just increases the mystery. And
what do you think if the pyramid was a nuclear power plant and something went crazy, they had a meltdown and killed everybody?
I think the nature of the energy was not nuclear.
Nuclear, okay.
No.
Was not that. We're going to run into a break, so we won't take a call until we come back.
I think if I could expand on that, I believe that the energy generation of that period was holistic, and they was in tune with and in harmony with the Earth. And if our civilization could attain that and become more in tune with the Earth, with our power generation, then we will have gained a lot.
Who taught them? That's the big question.
Yeah. That's a very good question.
And for them to have that kind of technology, even if it was 10,000 years old, they would have had to have had it a couple thousand years before that. I mean, something had to lead up to it. I mean, they just didn't wake up one morning and have this great idea.
But you could ask the question too, George, who taught us?
Well, that's true.
And even Isaac Newton said, if I've seen further than any other man, it's been from the shoulder of giants. So who taught him? You know, our technology and science has developed and over many, many years through inspiration and perspiration.
All right, we'll be back with more of Christopher Dunn and your phone calls when we come right back. Christopher, it's one thing being able to really find this granite down and precision cut it. It's another thing to try to determine how they move them around. What do you think?
I think that they had a technique for reducing the effects of gravity and were able to levitate the blocks. I strongly believe that.
Just like Edward Leeds Skolnick. Same technique.
I believe that he was the only guy who actually put his money where his mouth is and showed that he could move those blocks, and he said that he knew the secrets of how the pyramids were built.
Which leads me to believe that he might have been a reincarnated version of something, you know?
Quite possibly, yeah. He's certainly a very unusual man. I mean, there are some people who believe that there is no mystery to Coral Castle, and there are those that do. I'm afraid I'm one of those that believes strongly that there is still a mystery to be told.
I agree with you. Let's go east of the Rockies. You're on Coast to Coast. Hi there.
Good evening, gentlemen.
Yes, sir.
This is a fascinating program. It's just as fascinating and captivating as reading about the life of Nikola Tesla.
Well, that is indeed. I'll give you that.
Mr. Norrie, you open up your comments, mentioned something about license plates being read from satellites. Well, a friend of mine told me a few years ago, in relation to that same thing, that in Wisconsin, in the daytime, if you looked at your license plate off center from a site about, maybe 30 degrees looking down at it, you can see a very hidden, about 3/4 inch opaque strip of numbers and figures right down the center of the license plate.
Mm-hmm.
And I understand this is what a satellite can read and locate that plate.
That's interesting.
And I have another comment quickly. Your information leads me to believe that Mr. Tesla could have had the sources that you probably got, or somehow was utilizing information that you're getting. Is there some relativity there, possibly?
That's for you, Christopher.
Well, I would say that Tesla was certainly more of the genius than I would ever be. I think he was tapping into something a lot higher. My work is mostly detective work and drawing on the expertise of people like Tesla.
He understood sound, frequency, vibration.
Yes, absolutely.
And as you were saying, he almost took down a building in New York with it.
Yes, absolutely.
Let's go to our West of the Rockies line. Welcome to Coast to Coast. Hi there.
Hello, this is Miles in Tucson, Arizona.
Hi, Miles.
Hello. I wanted to mention something that is rather obscure. Maybe Mr. Dunn knows about it. In 1973, in the course of my graduate work in Greco-Roman studies and archaeology, I was in Thebes, the city of Thebes in Greece, which has a lot of archaeological and historical connections with Egyptian Thebes. In Thebes in Greece, right outside of the city, the modern city itself, which is quite small, there's a small pyramid made of earth. It's scooped out of the natural hill there. In the top of the hill is a tomb of the mythological twin brothers, Zephus and Amphion. And they were brothers, and they supposedly built the massive stone walls of Thebes. Zephus was a large person, supposedly boasted of his strength, and he lifted the blocks and put them and arranged the blocks. But Amphion was he played the lyre so beautifully that the blocks supposedly floated into place by themselves. And again, this is that use of harmonics that you've mentioned,
mm-hmm.
and I think the natives of Nandol in the South Pacific say that they, the blocks of that temple or that area were floated into place. There's a, in South America, in the Cusco region, the same type of legend about sound being used. And this little pyramid was excavated, I believe, in the late 60s by the Greek archaeologist Spiropoulos. And I guess that's all I have to add. It's quite interesting. They did find some Egyptian jewelry there. The tomb was pretty much raided in late antiquity. It's a two- or three-step pyramid. I have the excavation report here, which was in the Greek. I've translated that, and I haven't looked at it for some time, but it is quite interesting.
That sounds fascinating.
Yeah, you might check into that. The archaeologist's name is Spiropoulos.
Spiropoulos. That's a nice Greek name, isn't
yes,
it?
Yes, it is.
You know, Christopher, of all the theories I've heard about the pyramids and the possibilities, yours does make one really just kind of wake up a little bit and go, now this is possible. Primarily because it explains some of the very strange behavior of the pyramid itself. Why the granite? Why the need for that?
Mm-hmm.
You know, why not just do the whole thing in limestone, for example?
Oh, absolutely. And that was basically what anybody has to do, and if they posit a hypothesis or theory, they have to be able to explain all the evidence. And it has to fit. It has to have a reason for being there. And that was basically the standards I set for myself, and I wasn't satisfied until there was an answer for everything that exists. And because the hypothesis seems to be on fairly solid ground in terms of, you know, the basic hypothesis, the new information that turns up fits into the hypothesis too. So yes, I've heard many different theories, you know, if you are developing a theory to explain anything, you have to explain all the evidence.
Do you believe the Sphinx has anything to do with any of this?
Not really.
Okay.
The Sphinx certainly is legendary, and it has a symbolic importance to the ancient Egyptians.
But there's nothing structural about it.
And as far as any mechanical function, or I look at it as probably just a piece of municipal artwork that you would find in front of in the entrance to an important facility.
Very good. Wildcard Line, welcome to Coast Iran with Christopher Dunn. Hi there.
Hi, George. Hi, Christopher.
Yes, sir.
Hello.
How are you? My name is John. I'm calling from Southern Illinois. I think, George, you are from St. Louis.
I probably know exactly where you are out there somewhere.
I'm in Carbondale.
Oh, sure. Oh, well.
I'm in Danville. Hi, John.
Hey. I got a question for you. I have a background in sound, and George, I called in a couple weeks ago when you also had on about the pyramids. I have a background in sound, and I had a question. If you can clarify one thing first before I ask my question, the chamber that you're talking about, and the other wild card caller called about, is that actually inside the pyramid shape, or is that a rectangular chamber?
It is a rectangular chamber.
Because George, you asked earlier on in the show about the shape of the pyramid and why it would be in pyramid shape, and I'm only going to throw this out there. Just as a discussion.
Sure.
I'm curious to know, my experience in sound, if you have parallel surfaces, you can create standing waves. And I know Christopher was talking about these infrasonic waves that we could
mm-hmm.
only possibly feel and not necessarily hear. If these standing waves stand too long, there's a potential that they could disrupt actual physical structure, which is why when you build a studio, when you build an acoustical chamber, excuse me, you try to avoid parallel surfaces unless you want the resonated frequency.
Mm-hmm.
So I was just wondering if this is a possibility for why perhaps the chamber was had the rectangular shaped parallel walls, but the actual pyramid did not. and it's pyramid shaped because there are no parallel surfaces in a pyramid at all.
Correct. But the resonant chamber inside the Great Pyramid has parallel surfaces.
I wonder how much trial and error, Christopher, that they incurred before they got it right. I wonder if they made little tiny models.
Well, that's a very interesting question. There is a feature on the east side of the Great Pyramid, and this feature they call the trial tunnels. The interesting thing about these trial tunnels, which were described by Petrie in his book Pyramids and Temples of Giza, is that the dimensions and the shafts and shapes approximate those inside the Great Pyramid. In other words, you have the beginning of a descending passage with the same dimensions,
mm-hmm.
then a shorter ascending passage with the same dimensions, and then the bottom part of the Grand Gallery dimensions carved into the bedrock. So the argument has been in the past that the Khufu changed his mind twice before deciding on an upper chamber in the Great Pyramid. But the trial tunnels really negate that hypothesis. Because obviously the builders before they built the Great Pyramid knew about these characteristics and dimensions within the Great Pyramid. And what I propose in the Giza power plant is that, like any company who is developing new technologies, they would want to test it before they went live with it. So they were basically testing their equipment and using these trial tunnels to house the bottom part of their equipment.
All right, let's go to our East of the Rockies line. It is your turn with Christopher Dunn. Hi there.
Hello, this is Michael in Norfolk, Virginia.
Hi, Michael.
Hi, Mike.
Nice to talk to you again, Christopher. Later this month, our good friend here tonight, hosting the show, is going to be hosting a panel discussion with some very controversial guests coming on. And I think it's a bold and brave thing that he's doing. And I would suggest it for you, Christopher, and for Glenn Kimball and for Maurice Cottrell, because you've all brought forward some very bold and interesting insights on the pyramids that don't really come together in the program when there's just one person doing the interviewing. I like the panel discussion idea. I like what Cottrell says. He says it doesn't take a great civilization to produce great technology. It only takes one genius. He talks about Lord Baikal in that sense. I like what Glenn Kimball does. He points out that there are Hebrew inscriptions associated with some of the ancient buildings in Central and South America. Now, if Hebrew inscriptions showed up at the Great Pyramid in conjunction with the biblical explanation that storehouses were built there, and of course we do find a lot of grain dust in those pyramids,
mm-hmm.
If Hebrew inscriptions showed up there, do you think Zahi Hawass would be anxious to make that known?
Do I think? I think the politics is always in the forefront of Zahi's mind in revealing anything to the world. So,
I think you're right about that.
I think he probably wouldn't want to admit that.
By the way, my roundtable discussion with Alex Jones, Stephen Quayle, and Jim Mars will be April 22nd. That's just a little thing we do every once in a while where we put panelists together, rather one-on-one, we put three-on-one and things like that. And maybe we'll do it down the line on a pyramid show, too.
Sounds like an excellent idea.
The clock is ticking. I don't know if we're going to have enough time or not for another call. No, we shall not. But I do, first of all, want you to get your conference and your trip out one more time, if you would, Christopher.
Yes, thank you. It's actually, it's organized by Body, Mind, Spirit Journeys and World Explorers Club. It's from November 9th through the 21st, 2004. The telephone number is 800-231-9811 for those who wish to get more information, or they can go to the website. There is a link on my front page. But it promises to be an excellent tour.
And Christopher, tell me, what is it like for someone like you to be in a tomb, in a chamber of something that may have been built 5, 10, 15, 20,000 years ago?
Well, from my background and looking at the artifacts, I'm like a kid in a candy store. It's incredible. Every time I go to Egypt, I discover something new. I go with the intention of saying, well, you know, I noticed this particular thing the last time I was there. I didn't have an opportunity to really check it out. So the next time I go, I'm going to take this piece of equipment and I'm going to examine it a little more, take more photographs of one thing or another. But really, the trips that I've had to Egypt have been really, really wonderful. And the Egyptian people are wonderful people to be around.
Do you feel safe and secure there now?
I've never felt insecure in Egypt. I don't know whether they're still picking up the vibes from the pyramids, but they're very happy, very happy people, and they are very, very hospitable. You won't find a more hospitable people anywhere on the planet than the Egyptians, and I feel very comfortable traveling in Egypt and just being there. And in fact, now when I go there, they say welcome home. Because they just welcome you with open arms.
Well, nice job on this theory, and it's going to be interesting to see how many more mainstream archaeologists jump on board, Christopher, with what you have to say.
Well, I would say that for the ancient Egyptians, for the present Egyptians, the Egyptians today, get your own people involved, looking at these artifacts. And looking at them with the eyes, get the engineers and craftsmen involved, and have them interpret these artifacts, because this is the heritage of ancient Egypt that has not been told.
And probably the heritage of the world. Christopher, thank you so much. For Steve Carr, Dan Galante, Tom Danheiser, Lisa Lyon, Lex Lonehood, Barbara Simpson, and Art Bell, I'm George Norrie, somewhere out there on Coast to Coast AM. I'll see you on our next edition. Until then, be safe, everyone.